Albert said. I had a Bobby Dazzler last night. Talk about real. Tell me, I'm an expert on nightmares since I came to Australia. Not exactly a nightmare, this wasn't. Ah, hell. I can't explain. Go on, try. Mine are so real sometimes I can't even be sure they are dreams. I was bloody well dead asleep. I had a big Saturday. Must have been round midnight when I got to bed. Well, all of a sudden, I'm as wide awake as I am this minute, and there's such a stink of pansies in the room. I opens my eyes to see where it's coming from. I never knew pansies has that much perfume. Sort of dainty, but no mistaking it. Sounds bloody silly, don't it? Not to me, Mike said, his eyes fixed on his friend's face. Go on. Well, I opens my eyes, and the joint's as bright as day, although it's dark as hell outside. Never struck me as funny until I'm telling you now. He paused and lit a Capstan cigarette. That's right. Like the gas was full on. And there she is, standing at the end of the bed, exactly where you're sitting now. Who was? Who was it? Jeez, Mike, there's no call to get worked up over a bloody dream. He pushed the bottle across the table. My kid sister. You remember, the one I told you about, that was nuts on pansies? She seemed to be wearing some kind of nightgown. And that didn't strike me as funny either, not until now. Otherwise, she looked about the same as when I seen her last. Oh, about 6 or 7 years ago, I suppose. I forget now. Did she say anything? Or just stand there? Mostly just stand there, looking down at me and smiling. Don't you know me, Bertie? She says. And I says, of course I know you. Oh, Bertie, she says. Your poor arms with the mermaids, and the way you was lying there with your mouth wide open and that broken tooth, I would have known you anywhere. I'm just sitting up to get a better look at her when she starts to sort of... Oh, what the hell do you call it when a person starts to go all misty-like? Transparent, Mike said. That's right. How did you know? I calls out... Hi, sis, don't go yet. But she's almost gone. All but her voice. I could hear it, as plain as what I'm hearing you now. She says, goodbye, Bertie. I've come a long way to see you, and now I must go. I sung out goodbye, but she'd gone. Clean through that wall over there. You reckon I'm batty? Batty. If Albert's bullet head, so firmly screwed on to the squared shoulders, wasn't to be relied on for glorious common sanity, what was? If Albert was batty, there was no sense in believing in anything, in hoping for anything, or praying. No more sense in praying to the God Mike had been told to believe in ever since Nanny had dragged him to Sunday school in the village church. And there was God himself, in a red and blue glass window, a terrifying old man, rather like his grandfather, the Earl of Haddingham, sitting on a cloud and interfering with everyone down below. Punishing the wicked, caring for the sparrows fallen from their nests in the park, keeping an eye on the royal family in their various palaces, saving or allowing to be shipwrecked according to whim. Those in peril on the sea. Finding and saving or allowing to perish the lost schoolgirls on the hanging rock. All of which, and a good deal more, flashed through poor Mike's brain in a jumble of imagery impossible to digest, let alone communicate, as he sat staring at his friend, now grinning and repeating, "Betty! Just you wait till you have a dream like that." Mike rose, yawning. "Batty or not, you'll do me, Albert. I think I'll have another drink and turn in. Good night." Although the mist had cleared and the sun been up for some time when Mike was at breakfast next morning, daylight had not yet reached the gardens on the shady side of the mount, still in deep shadow, like a slab of cold grey stone. Mount Macedon, robbed of its summer beauty, might well be as bleak as the sodden Cambridge fields. He shivered as he picked up his valise, put on his overcoat, and walked down to the stables. Albert, who was driving him down to the Melbourne train, was whistling through his teeth as he hosed down the bricks, with Toby standing ready in the dog cart. The cob was eager to be off, tossing its smartly hogged little head and jingling its shiny bit. "Take your time, Mike. Little brute's got a mouth like iron, but I can hold him while you get in." They had just turned out of the avenue into the road when Albert jerked the lively cob to a standstill at the sight of Manasseh's boy, wobbling along on his sister's bicycle and bearing the morning's mail in a hand mottled with cold. "This is Cook's cough drops, Mr. Crundle. Will you take them? Half a mo. There's a letter here for you."
"What's the joke? Nobody writes me no letters."
"I can read, can't I? Your name's Mr. A. Crundle, ain't it?"
"Here, then. Hand it up, and none of your cheek."
"I'll be buggered. Who the hell can it be from?" As no answer was expected or given, the boy went wobbling off down a side lane in a huff, and the drive proceeded in silence until they pulled up outside the Macedon station. There was a good 10 minutes to spare before the arrival of the train, and Albert, being on friendly terms with the station master, they were invited to come in out of the cold and warm themselves at the fire in his office.
"Aren't you going to open your letter?"
Mike inquired.
"Don't mind me.
To tell you the truth, I'm not too clever at making out this kind of fancy writing. Better on the print.
How about you read it out to me?"
"Good heavens, there might be something private."
Albert grinned.
"Not unless the cops are after me. Far away."
The Albert, who had no inhibitions about the Toowoomba lock-up or having his private correspondence open and read aloud, continued to surprise and stimulate. At home, the family letters laid out in orderly rows by the butler on a boule table had an almost divine right of privacy. Feeling as if he were about to rob a bank, Michael took the letter, opened it, and began to read.
"It's written from the Galeface Hotel."
"Don't know the joint. Where is it?"
"At least it seems to have been written there and posted later from Fremantle. But cut out the frills. Just tell me what it's about and I'll nut it out again when I get home."
It was a letter from Irma Leopold's father, thanking Mr. Albert Crundle for his part in the finding and rescue of his daughter on the Hanging Rock.
"I understand you are only a young fellow and unmarried. My wife and I will be most happy if you will accept the enclosed check as a token of our everlasting gratitude. I understand from my solicitor that you are at present employed privately as a coachman.
If you have any wish to change your present employment at some future date, please do not hesitate to communicate with me at my banker's address below.
Jeez.
Further comment, if any, was cut off by the roar of the express coming into the station as Mike pushed the letter into Albert's seemingly frozen hand, picked up his valise, and jumped into the nearest compartment just as the train pulled out of the platform. 5 minutes later, Albert was still standing in front of the station master's fire, gazing at a check for £1,000. The hotels were not yet open in the township, but Mr. Donovan of Donovan's Railway Hotel was presently awakened by insistent knocking that brought him, still in his pajamas, to the side entrance of the closed and shuttered bar.
Oh, what the blazes! Oh, it's you, Albert. Help! We're not open for another hour.
I don't care if you're open or shut. A double brandy as quick as you can get it. This bloody cob won't stand.
Mr. Donovan, a good-natured soul, accustomed to the demands of persons in desperate need of strong liquor before breakfast, opened up the bar, produced a bottle and glass, and asked no questions. Albert, by this time, was reduced to much the same state of mind and body as on the memorable occasion when he had been knocked out in the 10th round by the Castlemaine Wonder. He was heading for home and halfway down Main Street when he caught sight of Irish Tom from the college, driving a hooded buggy on the opposite side of the road. Albert was in no mood to talk to Tom or anyone else, and merely raised his whip in greeting. Tom, however, was pulling up at the curb with such urgent nods and grimacings that he reluctantly reined in the cob. Whereupon Tom sprang from the buggy, threw the reins over the neck of the patient brown mare, and crossed the road to the dog cart.
"Albert Crundell! I haven't clapped eyes on you since that Sunday on the rock with the Johns. Seen this morning's paper?"
"Not yet. I don't go much on the papers, only for the racing."
"Then you haven't heard the news?"
"Stone the crows. Don't tell me they've found the other two Sheilas."
"Oh, no, nothing like that. Poor young creatures. See here, on the front page, fire in the City Hotel. Brother and sister burned to death. Glory be! What an end! As I said to many, if it's not one thing, it's another nowadays."
Albert glanced hurriedly at the paragraph, which revealed that the couple were on their way to Warrigal and that Miss Dora Lumley's previous address was entered on the hotel register as Care of Appleyard College, Bendigo Road, Wood End. Albert was sorry enough for anyone unlucky enough to be burnt alive in their beds, but at the moment he had other more important matters on his mind.
"Well, I'll be off now. Toby doesn't like standing for long."
Tom, however, was disposed to linger by the wheel of the dog cart for further conversation.
"That's a nice wee cut of a cob you got there, Albert."
"Lively," said the other. "Mind your hand. He don't like his tail touched when he's in the dog cart."
"I don't blame him. There's one like that down at the college. By the way, it wouldn't be known anyone on the Mount would be wanting a married couple. Me and Minnie's getting married on Easter Monday. After that, we'll be looking for a job."
Still, more or less stunned by the impact of Mr. Leopold's letter, the coachman could hardly wait to get back to the privacy of his attic room to read it again, and was gathering up the reins when something about the word job rang a bell. Tom was rambling on,
Minnie's auntie wants us to give her a hand with a bit of a pub she owns at Point Lonsdale. Did I tell you that's where we're going for a honeymoon? But I fancy something with horses myself. And Minnie, you don't know my Minnie, dainty as a fairy about the house, though I say it, never seen the likes of her with the silver. I'll keep me eyes skinned for you, Tom. It's on the cards. I might know something after Easter, but you never know. Ta-ta!
And off he clattered, round the turn into the Upper Macedon Road. Thus was decided within less time than it took Tom to cross the road to the buggy, a future of blissful domesticity for himself and Minnie beyond their wildest dreams. Another segment of the Hanging Rock pattern was nearing completion, in this instance with a spectacular flourish, embellished with unguessed-at future joys, including a comfortable cottage to be erected behind the stables at Lakeview, and later to be filled with merry-eyed infants, the spit and image of Irish Tom. One of them subsequently became a strapper in a racing stables at Caulfield and achieved undying fame for himself and his parents by coming in second in a field of 27 in the Caulfield Cup, at which point we can no longer concern ourselves with the fortunes of Tom and his Minnie, who, after all, are only minor threads in the pattern of the college mystery. Soon to take on a new and unpredictable turn in which they were fortunately not involved. As soon as Albert had unharnessed Toby, he sat down in the rocking chair and took out Mr. Leopold's envelope, which had been burning into his right hip the whole way home from the railway station. After laboriously deciphering the contents several times, he knew it by heart, address and all. A boon granted to the non-reading fraternity that accounts for their safe storage of any necessary factual information. The unlettered farmer who sows and reaps according to the seasons has no need of writing down the dates in a notebook. Thus, Albert, who always knew to the day precisely when Toby's mane was last hogged and when the mare was shod in Woodend, carefully placing the Leopold check in a jam tin under his bed, had no further need to refer to the letter, and after burning it over a stump of candle, sat down to think things over. Just as he himself, by a few casual words this morning, had effectively shaped the destinies of Tom and Minnie, so had Irma's father, in a moment of generous impulse, altered the entire course of Albert's life. It is probably just as well for our nervous equilibrium that such cataclysms of personal fortune are usually disguised as ordinary everyday occurrences, like the choice of boiled egg or poached eggs for breakfast. The young coachman, settling down in the rocking chair after tea that Monday evening, had no sense of having already embarked on a long and fateful journey of no return. Albert felt he could have done with a short holiday. He had always wanted to have a look at Queensland, and now, surely, was his chance. It was a decision easily made, and far less onerous than the necessity of writing at least three letters this very night that involved the borrowing of Cook's writing pad and three envelopes and unearthing a pen thickly encrusted with stale purple ink. In spite of these minor drawbacks, he knew what he wanted to say to each of his three correspondents, which was not always the case with people who can spell a good deal better and write more legibly than Albert Crundell. Even so, The nib was licked clean before he had actually got going on letter number one, which began smoothly enough with, "Dear Mr. Leopold, sir, you could have knocked me down with a feather when your letter and enclosed check received this morning, March 23. After which it struck the writer that apart from an occasional tip and the Colonel's sovereign at Christmas, he had never, within his memory, been given a present until today's magnificent gift. Except once, at the orphanage, when some well-meaning old hen had handed him a Bible. As it seemed necessary to say something more than a bare thank you, for a check of £1,000. Yes, there it was, large as life in the jam tin. He decided on telling Mr. Leopold how he had traded the Bible for 5 bob, in the hope of someday buying himself a pony. Well, sir, I was only a nipper, and of course I never got same having to earn my living when I turned 12, so we'll start now looking round for something with a bit of blood. About 14 hands. There is some real good horses about, if you have, say, £30 cash, which I now have, sir, thanks to your generosity. The rest of the money can sit tight in the bank, till I have had a good think what to do with it for the best. Well, Mr. Leopold, sir, I am still knocked sideways at your generous gift, so will now close, being near midnight. Again, with grateful thanks, and wishing yourself and your family long and prosperous life. Yours, gratefully, Albert Crundall." There was still something to be added in a postscript that took nearly as long to compose and get written down as all the rest of the letter. "It was really nothing what I done for your daughter on the rock. Anyone round here will tell you the same. It was my mate. A young chap by the name of Honourable Fitzhubert saved her life. Not me. Albert Crundall." Letter number two, to Colonel Fitzhubert, was much easier, giving the coachman's notice on a date suitable to both parties and recommending Tom from the college as a real good man with the horses and ending up, "You was always a good boss to me. I appreciate same, and if you want Lance's new saddle before the spring, is hanging on a nail in my room, better kept dry this damp weather. Your faithfully, Albert Crundall." The last letter, to Mike, was dashed off at breakneck speed with spelling thrown to the wind. Good old Mike knew he was no hand with a bloody pen. "Dear Mike, by geez, that check is a bobby dazzler, all right." The rest is of no special interest except perhaps the last sentence. "Well, Mike, meet me any day you say in the city. Do you know the Post Office Hotel in Bourke Street? We could have a beer and fix a date for Queensland. I have wrote to your uncle, re-turning in the job at Lake V, and all in order there, so you name the day. Albert." 15. In the morning of Sunday, the 22nd of March, Appleyard College presented the usual scene of bustling preparation as the boarders arranged themselves for church-going in Wood End. Deliberately cut off nowadays from unnecessary contacts with the outside world, the household had remained ignorant throughout the long, boring Sunday of the shocking news that would have sent every tongue in the place wagging, rules or no rules. There were no Sunday newspapers, and dinner was consumed while the charred timbers of the Lumley's Hotel lay smouldering in pale autumn sunshine. Constable Bumper had actually taken Sunday off for a day's fishing at Kyneton, gleefully returning at midnight with a solitary blackfish to be grilled for Monday morning's breakfast, a meal cruelly interrupted by the arrival of young Jim, with requests for information from the Melbourne papers. The dramatic death of the obscure little governess immediately linked up with the almost defunct college mystery in the journalist's mind. The staff at the college was short-handed that Sunday, and Mademoiselle and Miss Buck had both been called into action. Although it was Minnie's day off, the place was all anyhow, with Miss Lumley clearing out like that yesterday afternoon, and the good-natured housemaid had remained on duty. Rubbing up the table silver in the pantry, she saw, through the narrow window, the two governesses marshalling the gloved and hatted girls into the waiting wagonettes, and presently Tom with Alice and Cook in the buggy. Minnie had just come through the baize door leading into the hall, when to her surprise she saw the headmistress almost running downstairs, carrying what looked like a small basket in one hand. At sight of the housemaid, she stopped, hanging on to the stair rail. Minnie thought, as if she were feeling giddy, and beckoned her over.
"Minnie, surely this is your Sunday off?"
"It don't matter, ma'am," Minnie said. "We're all behind this morning, after yesterday."
"Come into the study for a moment. Is Alice on duty?"
"No, ma'am. Tom took her and Cook into church in the buggy. Did you want her for anything?"
"On the contrary." "You look tired, Minnie. Why don't you go and lie down?" And there was poor Tom, with not a tooth in his head since Thursday, and never a word of sympathy.
"I'll lay my tables first. Besides, somebody might call."
"Exactly. I was about to tell you that I am expecting Mr. Cosgrove some time this morning. Miss Sarah's guardian. I could see him through the window when he arrives, and I can easily answer the door myself."
"Well, ma'am, that don't seem right," Minnie said, wavering as a delicious little shoot of pain ran through her stomach.
"You're a good, reliable girl, Minnie, and you shall have £5 on your wedding day. Now do as I say and leave me. I have some business letters to attend to before Mr. Cosgrove comes."
"And laws, Tom," says Minnie that night. The old girl looks something awful, white as chalk and breathing like a steam engine.
£5! You could have knocked me down with a feather."
"Glory be, wonders will never cease," Tom said, putting his arm around her waist with a smacking kiss. He was right. They never will. As soon as Mademoiselle had returned from church and removed her hat and veil, she applied a soupçon of colourless face powder and lip salve and presented herself at the study door. It was then nearly 1 o'clock. As usual nowadays, it was locked.
"Come in, mademoiselle. What is it?"
"Might I have a few words with you, madame, before déjeuner, à propos de Sarah Webern?"
Although the governess was aware that Sarah was anything but a favourite with the head, she was unprepared for the expression that creased the older woman's face like an evil wind.
"What about Sarah Webern?"
The pebble eyes were alert, watchful. Almost, Diane decided afterwards, as if she were afraid of what I was going to say.
I had better tell you, Mademoiselle, you are wasting my time and your own. Sarah Weybourne left here this morning with her guardian.
The governess let fly an irrepressible, "Oh, no! No! When I saw her yesterday, the poor child was not fit to take a journey. Actually, madame, it is of Sarah's health that I wish to speak."
"She appeared well enough this morning."
"Ah, the pauvre enfant."
The head eyed her sharply.
"A troublemaker, from the very first."
"An orphan," mademoiselle said boldly. "One must, for those lonely ones, make the excuses."
"In fact, I doubt whether I shall accept her here for another term. However, that can be dealt with later. Mr. Cosgrove was insistent on taking the child with him there and then. It was most inconvenient, but I had no choice in the matter."
"You surprise me," mademoiselle said. "Mr. Cosgrove is a charming man with the perfect manners."
"Men, mademoiselle, are often inconsiderate in such things, as you will shortly be finding out for yourself."
The thin, humorless laugh belied the unchanging, watchful eyes. "Sarah's things," Diane said, rising.
"I regret I was not here to help her pack."
"I myself helped Sarah to put a few things she specially wanted in her little covered basket. Mr. Cosgrove was waiting downstairs in a hurry to get away. He had a cab or a carriage ordered."
"We may have passed them on the way home from church. I wish very much that I had seen them and waved goodbye."
"You are sentimental, mademoiselle, unlike most of your race. However, there it is. The child is gone."
Still, the governess lingered at the door. She was no longer afraid of the woman whose crackling Sunday taffeta disguised an aching body in aching need of rest, hot water bottles, the small feminine humanities.
"Is there anything else you wish to say, mademoiselle?"
Recalling an elegant little grandmother reclining for 2 hours every afternoon on a chaise longue, Diane, greatly daring, inquired if madame would perhaps consider asking the good Dr. Mackenzie for a little something for herself. There had been much fatigue. The early autumn.
"Thank you. No. I have always been an indifferent sleeper. What time is it? I forgot to wind my clock last night."
10 minutes to 1, madame."
"I shall not be coming in to luncheon. Kindly tell them not to lay a place for me."
"Nor for Sarah?"
mademoiselle unaccountably said.
"Nor for Sarah. Is that rouge I see on your cheek, mademoiselle?"
"Powder, Mrs. Appleyard. I find it becoming."
As soon as the impertinent hussy had left the room, the headmistress rose and bent over the cupboard behind the desk. Her hand was trembling so badly she could hardly open the little door. She kicked at it savagely with the rounded toe of her black kid slipper. It flew open, and a small covered basket fell out onto the floor. The headmistress remained in her private rooms for the rest of the day and retired early to bed. On the following morning, it was Irish Tom's melancholy pleasure, there being certain warm-hearted persons who find some consolation in being the first with the worst, to deliver to Mrs. Appleyard in person
the newspapers filled with lurid accounts of the Lumley tragedy. Somewhat to Tom's disappointment, the news had been received at headquarters in stony silence, with a peremptory, "Hand it to me!" Whereas in the kitchen regions, there had been a dramatic throwing of aprons over horrified heads and shrill, incredulous cries that such a thing could only happen only 2 days after Miss Lumley and her brother had actually been here, in this very house, which somehow underlined and intensified the dreadful thing, and made the flames nearer and more real. Tuesday passed without incident. Rosamond had arranged for a joint telegram of farewell to be sent to Irma during the afternoon, when the Leopold sailed for London, accompanied by a lady's maid, secretary, groom, and a half a dozen polo ponies. With the relaxing of Dora Lumley's petty disciplines, there was a welcome sense of freedom. The ghostly presence of the little figure in brown serge obliterated, at least for the boarders, by excited preparations for Wednesday's wholesale exodus for the Easter holidays. It was a long time since so much whispering and comparing of notes and even occasional laughter had been heard at Appleyard College. To add to an atmosphere of well-being, a few days of Indian summer were brightening the garden, and Mr. Whitehead was obliged to turn the sprinklers onto the hydrangea bed, where the heavy blue and purple heads were still blooming under the windows in the west wing. The newspaper forecast predicted a fine, mild Easter, gradually working up to a change on Easter Monday. The two brides-to-be compared notes on their respective trousseau, and Diane, joyously indiscreet, confided to the goggle-eyed housemaid the story of the emerald bracelet. "I have no other jewels," the governess told her. "Ours will be a very simple wedding. We have very little money and no relations except for those in France." Minnie giggled. "My auntie's giving us our wedding reception, and Tom reckons she's asked that many relations on both sides, there won't be room for the bride and bridegroom to get into the church." Miss Buck, having proved herself during her brief term of office useless for anything but imparting of rudimentary Euclid and arithmetic, Mademoiselle found herself occupied most of the day in all manner of small domesticities. Everyone, even cook and Mr. Whitehead, turned to the French governess for orders. During the morning she had run upstairs for a packet of pins when Alice, the under-housemaid, appeared on the landing armed with the bucket and brooms. "Minnie says for me to do out the big double room, but there's that many clothes and things lying about. I don't know where to begin."
"I'll help you," Mademoiselle said.
"Australian schoolgirls are very untidy, I find. I have had much practice of late in packing and folding their dresses."
"Miss Irma was the one," Alice said admiringly. "Gee, gold back brushes all amongst her shoes and brooches pinned in their petticoats. If it had been Miss Sarah, the madam would have been on her like a ton of bricks. That's what it is to be an heiress." Miranda's old room that used to be filled with light and air from the garden outside the two tall windows was almost in darkness when they opened the door. With the Venetian blinds all drawn except on the narrow window above Sarah's bed, still unmade and rumpled as she slept in it last.
"A bit spooky in here, isn't it?"
said the big blousy girl, throwing down her brooms and getting to work. The blinds rattled up on a scene of depressing disorder. Sarah's dressing gown over the back of a chair, a pair of bedroom slippers on the washstand.
Well, I never! She don't seem to have taken much with her, she said, dragging at the bed covers.
Here is a nightdress case and a sponge bag, Mademoiselle said, with the sponge still in it. Madame told me she only packed a few necessary articles in a small basket for the journey. It is best we put everything away in the wardrobe until Miss Sarah returns after the holidays.
They say the Guardian's got plenty of cash, Alice said, cheekily. Won't do him any harm to buy the kid a new dressing gown. Shall I put fresh sheets on the bed over there? That was Miss Miranda's, wasn't it? Now there was a lovely girl for you. A real toff and never too high and mighty to have a bit of a laugh with Minnie and me.
The blundering creature was insupportable.
No, take all the bed linen away and make the coverlets neat, comme ça?
Miranda would never again sleep in this house.
Beats me why young Sarah didn't go off on a Sunday morning in this nice blue coat with a fur collar. I'll say a kid of 13 don't have much sense when it comes to clothes.
Miss Sarah left in a hurry, and what she chose to wear for this journey has nothing to do with you, Alice. If you would please attend to the dusting. It must be nearly lunchtime.
She glanced up at the stopped clock on the marble mantelpiece, where a small photograph of Miranda smiled calmly down from a small silver frame. Unlike the majority of photographs, this one had an extraordinary feeling of life and reality. Alice went on dusting in offended silence, and Mademoiselle stood looking up thoughtfully at the portrait of Miranda.
Alice, she said suddenly, was it you who brought Miss Sarah her breakfast on Sunday morning?
Yes, miss. Minnie was having a sleep-in.
I hope she had an egg and some fruit. She had a migraine all day Saturday and had eaten nothing.
Alice, who had completely forgotten Minnie's instructions about the sick child's breakfast and had, in fact, brought her nothing on Sunday morning, merely nodded, which somehow seemed less of a mortal sin than a barefaced lie. Anyway, she was sick and tired of the boarders and their nonsense, and made up her mind, even as she finished dusting behind the two beds, to get herself a job as a waitress after Easter. Diane de Poitiers was especially wakeful on Tuesday night. The Easter moon, already large and brilliant, threw a silver shaft between the partly drawn curtains at her open window, which overlooked part of the West Wing. There was a light burning in Minnie's room. Otherwise, the whole building, or as much she could see of it, was in darkness. When she leaned out over the sill, she could see the steeply pitched slate roof shining under the moon, and beyond it, the squat little tower, black against the sky. Could it be true that the moon actually had something to do with the thoughts and even the actions of human beings millions of miles below on the earth? She could feel the tide of silver light flowing over her sensitive skin. Not only her mind, but her whole being was preternaturally awake and aware. She lay down again on the bed, but the faint zing-zing of a mosquito hovering close to the pillow twanged on the silence like a harp. Sleep on such a night was impossible. The moment she closed her eyes, she began thinking about the child, Sarah. Was she, too, wide awake under the moon? What sort of a man was the guardian behind his charming facade of good manners? Where had he taken her for the holidays? What did the future hold for the lonely, unloved child? Miranda was the only one at the college who had ever made Sarah smile, and now Miranda was gone. Miranda. Miranda smiling down from the mantelpiece in the oval frame was Sarah's most treasured possession.
Imagine, Mademoiselle. Miranda gave it to me for my birthday.
You should color it, Sarah. You are clever with your paintbrush,
Mademoiselle had suggested.
Miranda's hair is such a lovely color, like a ripe yellow corn.
I don't think Miranda would like that, Mademoiselle. Irma Leopold was crazy to curl it up for her, for the photograph, but Miranda said, straight hair or nothing, like it always is at home. Baby Joni wouldn't recognize his sister with curly hair. And that other day, in the Ballarat Gardens, how clearly it all came back to her now.
Sarah, your bucket, it bulges like the toad.
Oh, no, Mademoiselle, it isn't a toad.
Then what is it? It looks very ugly.
It's Miranda, Mademoiselle.
No, don't laugh, please.
If Blanche and Edith found out, they would never stop teasing. You see, I take it everywhere, even to church.
It just fits in that little oval frame. But promise me never to tell Miranda.
That small pointed face was flushed and solemn.
Why not? Diane said, laughing. It is amusant, ça? Nobody has ever taken me to church in their pocket.
Because, said the child earnestly, Miranda wouldn't approve. She says she won't be here much longer, and I must learn to love a whole lot of other people besides her. What could have occurred on Sunday morning to make her forget to take the portrait off the mantelpiece as usual? Such a little thing, so easily carried. In a hurry, Alice. I have just told you, Miss Sarah was in a hurry and forgot her dressing gown. A dressing gown, a sponge bag, easily forgotten by the excited child and grimly undomesticated adult who had helped pack a few things in a little covered basket. But not the portrait. Never, never the portrait forgotten and left behind. Was she perhaps seriously ill? So ill that Madame had refused to admit it. Had the guardian sworn to secrecy, driven the child away to a hospital? A puff of night air blew the lace curtains into the room. She was cold, dreadfully cold, and afraid. Throwing a wrapper over her shoulders, she lit a candle and sat down at her dressing table to write to Constable Bumfer. By the afternoon of Wednesday the 25th, the last of Hussey's cabs had carried the last of the boarders down the drive. The silent rooms overflowed with drifts of paper, dropped pins, scraps of ribbon and string. In the dining room, the fire was out. The carnations, in tall glass vases, on their last legs. From the staircase, the grandfather clock had become so loud that Mrs. Appleyard fancied she could hear its everlasting tick-tock through the study wall. Minute by minute, hour by hour, like a heart beating in a body already dead. Minnie had come in at dusk with the mail on a silver salver.
"It's late today, ma'am. Tom says it's because of the Easter trains. Shall I draw your curtains now?"
"As you like."
"There's one here for Miss Lumley. Will you take it?"
The headmistress held out a hand.
"I shall have to find out the brother's address in Warrigal."
Who but the Lumleys would have died without leaving an address? Dora Lumley had always been a muddler with her letters. Even now, she sat staring at the heavy curtains that shut out the gentle twilight garden, thinking how few things in life were unmuddled, firmly outlined, as they were surely intended to be. One could organize, direct, plan each hour in advance, and still the muddle persisted. Nothing in life was really watertight, nothing secret, nothing secure. Take people like Dora Lumley and the child Sarah. Weaklings. You had them firmly under control, and the moment you turned your head, they wriggled through your fingers. Mechanically, she picked up the pile of letters and began sorting them out, as she always insisted on doing with her own hand. Two or three for the staff, one in Louis Montpellier's thin purple ink for Mademoiselle, a coloured postcard for Minnie from Queenscliff, the baker's preposterous account left by hand in a dirty envelope. No checks. Directly after Easter, she would have to go to Melbourne and sell some shares, and she could go to Russell Street at the same time. If ever constructive action was called for, it was now. Much as she would have preferred the privacy and solitude of dinner alone, this evening she pulled the bell by the fireplace.
"Alice, I shall be dining downstairs with Mademoiselle and Miss Buck. Kindly tell cook and ask her to send in a tray after dessert with black coffee, sugar, and cream for three."
No detail at this juncture was unimportant. A specially careful toilette, with a velvet bow at her throat and an extra brooch. Mademoiselle would notice such trifles and find them reassuring. Miss Buck, of the blank, tooth-filled grin and thick spectacles, might well be a suspicious type. One never knew with young women supposed to be brainy. There were dolts and dullards who saw too much, others who saw nothing. Oh, for the guiding hand of Arthur. Even the cool appraisement of Greta McCraw. For the first time in many weeks, she thought of the mathematics mistress and brought her fist down on the dressing table with such force that the combs and brushes and curling pins danced on its polished surface. It was inconceivable that this woman of masculine intellect, on whom she had come to rely in the last years, should have allowed herself to be spirited away, lost, raped, murdered in the cold blood, like an innocent schoolgirl on a hanging rock. She had never seen the rock, but its presence was often with her of late. A brooding blackness solid as a wall. At dinner that evening, the two young women had never seen the head so gracious, positively loquacious. The governesses were already stifling their yawns after the hectic activities of the day when Miss Buck was requested to ring for Minnie.
"There is a little brandy, I think, in the decanter in the pantry. You remember, Minnie, the day the Bishop of Bendigo came to lunch."
The decanter and three glasses were brought. They sipped at it, delicately, and even drank to the health and good fortune of Mademoiselle and M. Montpellier. Diane, wearily taking up her candle at 11 o'clock, thought it was the longest evening she had ever spent. The clock on the stairs had just struck for 12:30 when the door of Mrs. Appleyard's room opened noiselessly, inch by inch, and an old woman carrying a nightlight came out onto the landing. An old woman with head bowed under a forest of curling pins, with pendulous breasts and sagging stomach beneath a flannel dressing gown. No human being, not even Arthur, had ever seen her thus, without the battle dress of steel and whalebone in which for 18 hours a day the headmistress was accustomed to face the world. From the window at the top of the staircase, moonlight fell upon the row of closed cedar doors. Mademoiselle slept at the far end of the corridor, Miss Buck in a small room at the rear of the tower. The woman, with the nightlight, stood listening to the tick-tock, tick-tock, coming up out of the shadows below. A possum scudding across the leads overhead made her start so violently that the little lamp almost fell from her hand. By its feeble light, the big double bedroom appeared in perfect order, fresh, chintzy, and smelling faintly of lavender. The blinds were all drawn to the same level, disclosing identical rectangles of moonlit sky and the dark tops of trees. The two beds, each with a pink silk eiderdown quilt neatly folded, were immaculate. On the dressing table, flanked by two tall pink and gold vases, the heart-shaped pincushion where she had found and instantly destroyed the note. Again, she saw herself bending over the child in the smaller of the two beds. Eyes, hardly a face now, only those enormous black eyes burning into her own. Again, she heard her cry out,
"No, no, not that, not the orphanage."
The headmistress shivered, wishing she had put on a woolen spencer under her nightdress. She put the nightlight down on the bedside table, opened the cupboard where Miranda's dresses were still hanging on the left-hand side, and began methodically to go through the shelves. On the right, Sarah's blue coat with the fur collar, a little beaver hat, shoes, tennis rackets, now the bureau, stockings, handkerchiefs, those ridiculous cards, dozens of them. Valentines. Directly after the holidays, she would have Miranda's things removed. Now the dressing table, the washstand, the little walnut work table where Miranda kept her coloured wools. Lastly, the mantelpiece. Nothing of any significance there, only a photograph of Miranda in a silver frame. The first grey light was showing under the blinds as she closed the door, put out the nightlight, and threw herself onto the great four-poster bed. She had found nothing, deduced nothing, decided nothing.
Another dreadful day of enforced inaction lay ahead. The clock was striking 5. Sleep was out of the question. She rose and began taking the curlers out of her hair. Thursday was unseasonably warm, and Mr. Whitehead, who was